Thank you very much. I also don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So today I'll be presenting on my research presentation here using the theory of planned behavior to predict snack food consumption among upper elementary age school children. So as I'm sure you're all aware, the issue of childhood obesity is continuing to be a major public health issue. About 32% of our kids, of all kids in the U.S., are either overweight or obese. And about a quarter of all European children are either overweight or obese. And as I tell my students, obesity is really a simple concept when it comes down to it, in that it's simply an energy imbalance. You know, individuals are eating more calories than they're expending. However, the driving forces to this imbalance are actually quite complex. There's been issues of the environment that we've been talking about today, and characteristics of individuals' lifestyles have been related to the development of obesity. So the dietary behavior that I'll be talking about today specifically is snacking, or snack foods. Across, you know, from young to old, snacking's increased among all segments of, you know, age groups. Kids nowadays get about a quarter of all of their calories from snack foods, and a recent study showed that about, you know, over 90% of kids snack at least once per day. Snacks are also very highly energy dense, so making them really easy to passively overconsume. Snack foods are also a big public health issue because they're heavily advertised to kids. You know, recently a study showed that with Saturday morning television, cartoons, what advertisements kids were being exposed to, snack foods were the third most of what kids were seeing with relation to the types of foods they were being exposed to, with cereals being number one and restaurants being number two. Snack foods are also relatively cheap. So a study looked at kids who were buying foods before and after school at their local grocery store, convenience store, and they found that on average kids were buying about two items per day, either before or after school. These two items were giving them an extra 350 calories, and it was only costing them about a dollar. Snack foods are also targeted at the policy level. The National Institute of Medicine published this report, Nutrition Standards for Schools, leading the way to healthier youth, which really recommended schools start really regulating what they're selling outside of the school lunch program. Since this was published, over 20 states have adopted some legislation or some policy that mandates what can be sold outside of school lunch, so trying to regulate those snack foods and those extra foods. So with these policies, health education strategies are also needed. And these health education strategies should have some kind of theoretical underpinnings. Okay, if you look at childhood obesity research, sociocognitive theory is a theory that gets used most of the time. So a recent meta-analysis looked at interventions that were geared towards obesity prevention. And they found that for those interventions that seemed to be working most efficiently, the underlying variable was social cognitive theory, that these interventions were either implicitly or explicitly based in social cognitive theory. Now, a newer theory that's being used, at least in obesity prevention, is a theory of planned behavior. This was introduced in 1985 by Dr. Ajahn as an extension of theory of reasoned action. And you can see it's a little bit more of a parsimonious model if you compare it to social cognitive theory, whereas here there's four constructs that are really predicting behavior, whereas with social cognitive theory there's eight or nine constructs that are predicting behavior. So as you can see here, those constructs that do predict behavior within theory of planned behavior are attitudes, subjective norms, or perceived behavioral control, which predict intentions, and then those behavioral intentions directly predict behavior. So the purpose of this study was to examine the extent that these constructs of theory of planned behavior can predict snack food consumption among school-aged children, which help provide direction for future theory-based health-promoting interventions. So this study is a cross-sectional study. We used a convenience sample of fourth and fifth grade children. We evaluated the constructs of theory of planned behavior using a 13-item survey, and you can see how many items we're evaluating each construct. We tried to keep it, you know, a rather brief survey, given that kids' attention spans, they don't want to be taking, you know, a 50-page questionnaire. So you can see some example questions for these constructs, intentions. You know, I plan to choose lower calorie snack foods between my meals. I think another question was, I intend to choose lower calorie snack foods between my meals. So all these questions were trying to gear towards that construct. And then we also measured snack food consumption. We measured snack food consumption through a sort of a modified 24-hour recall. So we actually, on the survey, the first thing that the kids saw were a series of lines. And these lines, we asked the kids to report in the best detail that they could what they ate between breakfast, lunch, and dinner the previous day. So while they were filling that out, we encouraged them to think about, you know, what type of food was it? You know, we said if it's a cookie, what type of cookie was it? How many did you have? Was it a big one? Was it a small one? We try to give them, you know, any cue to try to help them remember. And we entered those foods into the USDA nutrient release, which is a really good system that you put foods in, and it gives you a really nice nutrient profile for you know, calories, fat, carbohydrates, for essentially almost any type of food. Now, a really good thing about that software as well is that it'll give you sort of reference foods. So for example, there would be kids who just put, you know, cookie. Okay, well, you know, what good does it, what exactly does that mean? So if you type in cookie to the search engine, it'll at least give you, you know, a standard amount, you know, medium cookie, and it'll give you a standard, you know, calories and fat for that type of food. So after we measured these things, we used two rounds of stepwise multiple regression. The first round, we predicted intentions by using attitudes, norms, and control. And then the second round, we looked at calories from calorically dense, nutrient-poor snack foods. So these are the, you know, snack foods, cookies and chips. These are the poor snack foods. And then we also looked at calories from fruit and vegetable snacks. Okay. And those were predicted by intentions, age, race, and gender. Given that this was stepwise multiple regression, we used an a priori criteria to enter the model at an alpha of 0.05 and a criteria to be removed from the model of an alpha of 0.1. To establish validity and reliability of the scale, we first created the scale and sent it to a panel of six experts to establish content and face validity and also readability. We used a two-round review process where the entire panel gave back feedback, and then the survey was adjusted based on their feedback, and it was sent out again to kind of make sure that they all agreed that it was looking, you know, good. We also looked at construct validity using confirmatory factor analysis, using principal component analysis. We looked at the Scree plot and the eigenvalues to assure there was a one-factor solution for each subscale, and each item loaded significantly on each given subscale using an a priori limit of 0.36. We looked at Cronbach alpha, which is the internal consistency reliability, and most of the scales were valid. You can see they range from 0.57 to 0.887. Usually you want them all at least around 0.7 and above, so I think one or two scales fell below that. And we also looked at test-retest reliability. So a small group of children took the survey twice within the same day, and again, they ranged from some being valid, and I think one or two were lower than what you would want to expect. In all, we had 174 children enrolled in the study. You can see slightly more female than male. We had a pretty good mix of races represented, so less than half were Caucasian, close to 15% were Black, African American, 20% Hispanic, and a good 10% were other, a lot of multiracial children at these schools. You can see these are sort of just the means and standard deviations from what we found. So, you know, on average, kids were eating about 312 calories from these, you know, calorically dense, nutrient-poor snack foods, okay? Huge range, though, right? You can see some kids were eating none of these, and some kids were eating upwards of, you know, 1,200, 1,300 calories a day with these types of snack foods. Same thing with fruit and vegetable snacks. You can see these are all in calories again. We didn't include 100% fruit juice as part of those fruits and vegetables. And then you can see what those mean scores were for behavioral intentions, attitudes, subjective norms, and perceived behavioral control. So this is the first set of regression that we use, parameter estimates from the final regression model for intentions as predicted by attitudes, subjective norms, and perceived control. You can see that it explained quite a large percentage of the variance, and each one was significant. You can see this one is for intentions and race were found significantly predicting fruit and vegetable intake. So those students with higher intentions were eating more fruits and vegetables, and those children with lower intentions were eating more calorically dense, nutrient-poor snack foods. Okay, race and gender were also significant predictors that entered into the model. So in conclusion, as childhood obesity increases, so does the need for innovative and effective theory-based interventions that can target these modifiable risk factors such as diet, physical activity, and sedentary activity. And these our results support that snacking is a major part of children's daily caloric intake. You know, on average, kids were consuming 312 calories a day. However, you did see that large range that we saw some kids eating much more. We had a pretty large standard deviation for that one as well. Theory of planned behavior does appear to be a useful and robust theory for targeting snack food consumption among children. You can see intentions were strongly predicted by those constructs, you know, as predicted by the theory. And you can see those calorically dense snack foods were negatively predicted by intentions, whereas fruits and vegetables were positively predicted by intentions, which is what we, again, would want to see. So future health-promoting interventions should consider, you know, utilizing this theory, especially those that, you know, are for obesity prevention. Some limitations of this study, the validity and reliability was measured for this scale and were found mostly adequate. However, there were some subscales that did not meet the requirement for Kronbach alpha and test-retest reliability. This is a convenient sample of children in the Midwest, so it's difficult to generalize this to all children across the U.S. So the generalizability is a limitation. It was a one-day dietary recall, so we assume that that one-day dietary recall is representative of a child's normal snack food intake. So, and also the instrument was self-report, so we do assume that the children were being honest when they filled these reports out. And that's it. So I think we have time for some questions, if anyone has any. Okay, yeah, in the back. We used multiple regression. I guess my advisor and I looked at that, and it was really just to make the results, I guess the way he put it was easiest to explain. So we did want to use SEM, structural equation modeling, because the theory does lend itself to using that. However, we only had the student version available, and we didn't have the full version available. And the student version only allows you to have a certain amount of constructs. So that was the method that we decided on using. And I think in the future, we're going to try to use SEM as actually another way to analyze those results. Yeah, at the back. That's a really good point. Actually, if you look at the American Dietetic Association's evidence library, they list snack foods as like a grade 3 evidence, where it's basically the results are conflicting. Because, and the reason why they state that is because of that, the definition for snack food hasn't been well established. So the definition that I've really been sticking to is foods eaten outside of breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So some individuals will use, you know, for example, chips. You know, we commonly associate that with a snack food. However, you know, you can have that for lunch. Well, if you had chips for lunch, is that a snack food? Or is it part of, you know, is it a lunch food? Or is it both? Or how exactly do you interpret that? So the way that I've done, and I've done a few studies with snacking, is that what I do first is I just look at those foods outside of those meals, and then you can start, I categorize the foods into, you know, fruit and vegetable snacks, calorically dense, energy poor snacks, and that's the way that I've been doing it. Yeah.
Then they'll say, I have soda. Mm-hmm. They say, was that breakfast, lunch, dinner, or snack? And
yeah. Yeah. No, that's. Yeah. Diet assessment is definitely a tricky thing when you're looking at, you know, these types of things. So, the way that we did that with our kids was we just basically said breakfast, lunch, and dinner as you see them as breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So, yeah.
I'm curious about whether you did any research or if there's research out there on what children of that age would perceive to be nutritious versus not nutritious. I think most of your questions were about intention of eating low-calorie foods, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, breakfast might be low-calorie, but nutritionally void. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just curious, at a third
grade level,
what is it?
Yeah. Geez, that's a good question. I'm not off the top of my head, it's difficult for me to comment on that. But the thing that we've been looking at with our obesity prevention research is really calories. So calories seems to be the driving force that we teach kids about. When it comes to snack foods, we try to teach kids about lower calorie snack foods, which, you know, isn't always a perfect system. Like you're saying, nuts and seeds are something that we recommend, but they're also energy dense, but they're not nutrient poor. So that's one of those kind of sticky areas when it comes to how do you, you know, best promote foods to a general public and try to be right all the time. It can be very difficult, so. Sure. Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd like to open it up if you have questions for the rest of the panel. Hearing all of the talks inspired some questions, so we have some time if you'd like to direct them to specific panel members. And the person in the green.
The question was, how long in residency was that looked at, and maybe that influences how you're affected by an obesogenic environment. And I totally agree with that. The behavioral risk factor surveillance survey does not ask that, but we are doing more localized at a community and what they're doing so we can get more perspective from that point. But I think you're right. How long are you being exposed to that specific environment? Very good.
There's a question in the back.
Actually, that was one thing we evaluated because that was a concern, or definitely that's an avenue. First, I need to tell you that it can only be done in congregate sites. So senior centers, hospitals, daycares. So that is a limitation. We only had three way out stations, one I ran and two others. We could get people through that fast, so that was not a problem as far as the speed as what we could get through, and they could sit down and eat and not have an impact of their eating time. That's also in the school wellness program you have to have. Now, cost. It actually was, after we evaluated, lower cost than observation. Observation, you have to have, we had four people. They looked at three kids for three different school lunch periods. And then they had to go back and do the analysis. There's a huge amount in the diet, the nutrition assessment tool, the spheres of preloading. You have to preload all the nutrients. You have to preload a lot of things, preload what barcode. But once you've preloaded, it automatically will calculate it that day, that minute. I could actually tell you how many nutrients that child ate right as they went past the line. But if you're going to start it, it costs about $21,000 to buy all the machinery. That's the table, the trays, the everything. But when we calculated that in, we actually still had a lower cost because instead of 36 children or 37 every day, we did over 150 on the other one. So it's hard to start in the amount, and we had three employees that did it, plus one who roamed the room to make sure for spillage or anything, a sharing or those kind of things that occur with elementary stool. Yes. Exactly. For breakfast, we weighed exactly what they took, and then they put the tray back, and we weighed exactly what came back. For lunch, we weighed exactly what went out, and we weighed exactly what came back. It was a breakfast lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this school had a salad bar. And so if they had a salad bar, we had, if the nutrients, well, most of them were little trays that they could put up and put their lettuce in and then their different items so that we could weigh them. So that is another thing you have to take into account is when they have their free choice of variety of nutrients within one thing that you have to have a different container.
Question from Delaney Green. And your question?
Okay.
So,
it would be nice to be able to link the school breakfast consumption, improved consumption, and improved compliance with dietary guidelines with academic outcomes.
Yep.
In our N-of-1 school in the small school district, we mentioned it found an 8% increase in reading scores and a 6.5% to 7% increase in math scores within 1 year of implementing
Well, that's a good observation because actually most research has not shown that as much, that everyone wants it to improve, but that's not what the research has actually been exposed and seen. So at least you saw it, but a lot of other research hasn't. Now we're looking at does price, timing, and price, timing, and location, all which factors are the driving force, and that's an economic research that I'm doing with an economist. So, but that's a very good point.
One more question from the person in the back.
We have six observation forms, so there was some feedback around shortening trainings. People wanted more field practice and less classroom presentation, but specific to the fast food observations, I don't recall if that was a particular issue.
Join me again in giving the panel a round of applause.